From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Dick Ebersol, the chairman of NBC Sports, announced his resignation today after a career spanning more than four decades. The news comes not long after Comcast completed its takeover of NBC Universal, and just weeks before NBC and other networks are set to bid on broadcasting rights for the 2014 and 2016 Olympic Games. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now from our New York bureau to talk more about this. And David, tell us a bit more about Dick Ebersol. What does he represent for NBC?
Well, he's really a giant in sports TV and perhaps one of the last giants in the old legacy networks. He had started as a protege for the legendary Rune Arledge over at ABC and had interned for him on the Olympics in the late 60s. He came over to NBC. He helped to create Saturday Night Live, which I think a lot of people forget. And then he really, as he took over sports in the late 80s and for 22 years led that for NBC, he really had a lot of those mammoth deals with the NFL and with the Olympics in particular, forging strong relationships and making that a marquee element of the NBC brand.
And how important is that to the NBC brand, the coverage of the Olympics?
Well, the relationship is just extraordinarily close. I mean, if you think about it, it's a $2 billion deal, got NBC the licensing rights to broadcast the games here through 2012, the London Games next year. NBC actually has a senior vice president, which sits on the board of commissioners of the International Olympics Committee. And GE, which until this year was the majority owner of NBC, was a global sponsor of the most recent Olympics in Beijing 2008, the Summer Games. They're really hard to disentangle the two.
So very important to the network and a lot of questions now. What do Comcast's intentions appear to be as those Olympic negotiations near?
Well, the network took pains to say that this, you know, quietly off the books, that this was a departure that had to do with the negotiation over Mr. Ebersol's contract, not about its intention towards the games. Comcast has said publicly it intends to bid vigorously for the games at the time at which they put in their bid next month. That said, Comcast is taking a much more gimlet eye on the question of profits and losses. NBC took an economic downturn, took a loss of about $200-plus million for the Winter Games Vancouver in 2010. Comcast doesn't want anything like that, and it's looking very carefully at it. In this time, in addition, ESPN is expected to make a very muscular bid for the first time, a very competitive bid, and Fox 2 is said to be interested in getting into the game.
That's NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you very much.
You bet.
Broadcast and cable networks are in New York this week presenting their fall schedules, giving TV fans everywhere hope that the new crop of shows might be better than the last. At this annual gathering, the networks sell commercial time to advertisers in advance or up front, about $9 billion worth in past years. Kim Masters, an editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter, has been covering the upfronts all this week. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
And among the network presentations, let's start with NBC, which has really been struggling in the ratings for the last several years.
Yes, NBC went first, and you have to picture these are big venues filled with advertisers, and NBC has been struggling. It's been bought by Comcast, the cable giant. It has a new chairman. His name is Bob Greenblatt. He used to run Showtime. There is more hope around Bob Greenblatt that he will somehow save this network. He did roll out a lot of new shows. I think the one that is clearly closest to his heart is called Smash. It has Deborah Messing and apparently a breakout performance by Catherine McPhee, who was a contestant on American Idol a few years ago. It's behind the scenes on a Broadway show. Steven Spielberg is involved, and it's not coming till mid-season, but obviously Bob Greenblatt loves this show.
So after seeing the NBC presentation, you switched gears and you went to a very successful networks presentation, Fox.
I'll tell you, it was such a contrast, Renee, on Monday. The first NBC kind of doing its best to sell a lot of new shows with a lot of uncertainty. And then Fox just comes powering out with all of its stars, with House, with Glee. And of course, it has a couple of huge new things coming onto its network in the fall. X Factor, which brings Simon Cowell back with Paula Abdul, his old partner from American Idol. This show has been a giant hit in other countries, and it feels like they call American Idol Death Star, and this could be Death Star too. It's also looking to add comedies, as are all the networks, and some new stuff, but they don't have a lot of real estate because they've got a lot of hits.
And in the other direction, I gather ABC is having to introduce a lot of new shows this fall.
They are throwing a pile of new shows onto the schedule, too, to try and find the hit. And they have a very soapy sort of, they called it pure candy. They're doing Charlie's Angels. They're going to have a show called Good Christian Bells, which was not the original title. You'll have to think about what the B stood for originally. This is based on a series of books that are very popular. And then they're trying to get the guys in with a little comedy. They are bringing Tim Allen back. He hasn't been on a series since Home Improvement, which was a very big performer in the day. And he's back again, and they've got a little group of comedies about, it seems like, men who are terrified about losing their masculine identity. That seemed to be one of the sub-themes of this year's pilot season.
Okay, so ABC. Now let's move on to the number one network, CBS.
The big story there is, of course, they have found a replacement for Charlie Sheen, Ashton Kutcher. They're going to reboot Two and a Half Men. That is the number one sitcom on television. That is a huge, valuable property for CBS and Warner Brothers, which produces it.
You know, and finally, and of course, this is all important at these upfronts, spending on television ads fell off when the economy was at its worst a few years back. Is it turning around?
Absolutely. The networks are, I think, feeling very hopeful. You know, it's a sort of counterintuitive. The TV audience, the broadcast audience, is continuing to fragment. You know, there's a lot of other stuff to do in the digital era. But TV still aggregates those eyeballs. TV broadcast is still the big tent. So they're thinking they could go to $10 billion this year in ad sales, and that's a lot of business.
Kim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
Kim Masters is speaking to us from our New York bureau. She hosts The Business on member station KCRW.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Almost everything about Tayari Jones' new novel, Silver Sparrow, is cleaved into two halves. It's the story of two sisters. One is named Dana, the other Charisse. They have different last names, they lead different lives, but they share the same father, and they live in different parts of the same city. Their father, James Witherspoon, is a bigamist, which by definition means that he's a complicated man. And this is a complicated, heartbreaking, and very rich story about how secret sisters find each other, but lose as much as they gain in the process. Tayari Jones joins us here in the studio to talk about her latest book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I feel like we should clear something up right at the get-go, because I bet a lot of people read this book or read about this book and wonder if you yourself have a secret sister.
That's so funny. You know, when it comes to memoir, we want to catch the author in a lie. And when we read fiction, we want to catch the author telling the truth. I would like to say that my father is not a bigamist.
So this did not spring from your own family history. Where did the story come from?
Well, you know, I do have a sister. I have two sisters. They're not secrets, though. They're about 10 years older than me, but they didn't grow up with me. They're my father's daughters. And we have different last names, and we live different lives. We don't have that web of secrecy between us, but I've always felt that I had a sister that was just outside of my grasp. And so I started thinking about this idea of sisters and secrets. And then I was in a bar once with some friends having happy hour. And someone mentioned one of those stories you hear all the time about a man who dies and then two wives show up at the funeral. And so when I thought about that and I mixed it with my own wonderings about my own family, boom, this came together and the story was born.
You note in the novel how common this is, so common that most churches have smelling salts for the widow who thinks she's the only wife when the second wife shows up.
Oh, it happens all the time. But even more common than that is this idea of what I used to call half siblings until my nephew said, don't say half. He said, there are no half people. My mother's your sister. She's not your half sister. And I realized that so many people have fathers who have other children, even if it's not simultaneous and in a bigamous relationship. Or I was giving a reading in Florida and a woman had me sign her book, and she said that on Father's Day, she had written on her Facebook status something like, you know, Happy Father's Day to the greatest dad in the world. And she had seen her sister's Facebook page, and her sister had written, I never had a father because the coward wasn't there. It's the same man. So what does that mean?
Hmm. Help us understand the title of this book. What does Silver Sparrow mean?
Well, Charisse thinks of a silver girl as a girl who's better than she is. Kind of a, when I was growing up, I would have called a fancy girl. A girl who's lovely and popular and smart. All the things that your adolescent self feels that you are not.
And we should say Charisse is the daughter who is able to live in the open as
yes.
the daughter of
yes.
James.
Yes, she is the accepted daughter. In talking about this book, I've had to get all new language because the impulse is to say legitimate daughter, but all people are legitimate. That's one thing this book has taught me is that everybody, every person is legitimate. But Charisse, she doesn't think of herself as a privileged person. She doesn't know that her father has a daughter that lives in the shadows and feels unprivileged. She thinks she lives an ordinary life. She thinks she's just an awkward teenage girl. And then she meets this silver girl, Dana, who she thinks is the most beautiful person ever. So that's where I got silver from. And I took sparrow from the hymn, His Eye is on the Sparrow, being the sparrow is the least among us. Because I think that's what Dana is. She is a silver sparrow.
And she's always looking at Charisse.
She's
with
always,
envy.
With envy and with fascination. Because she wants in. She wants into that family. She wants to be a sister.
I want to ask you about James.
Okay.
He's an interesting character. He is a bit of a Lothario. He's very seductive, but he's also deeply flawed and, as we said, very complicated. He stutters and sometimes so violently that his whole body moves when he tries to speak. Is that the way he first entered your imagination? Did he stutter when you first heard him in your head?
Yes, that was one of the first things I knew about him, this stammer, because I thought a man like him to have two women, it would be such an interesting thing to say, how could he get two women? And I realized the same, when you get one woman, you get another one. And it also made him interesting because I didn't think he should be so suave, like he's just, you know, a lady killer. I wanted each of his relationships to come from kind of genuine human interaction and need, like real need. He loves both these women. His crime is that he loves them simultaneously, but it's not that he seeks to use anyone or have notches on his bedpost. He actually has two wives.
I follow you on Twitter, so I know that you love Toni Morrison. You talk
I do.
A lot about her influence on your work. As a writer and as someone who teaches writing, are you always conscious of the potential impact that you have on the next generation of writers?
I am interested in my impact on young writers, mostly about what I do in the classroom, not so much my books. I take mentoring very seriously, and I'm on the board of an organization called Girls Write Now, where we match teen girls and writing mentors because it changes their lives. And that's what I really think about, is helping other young writers find their voice. Because art, writing, story changes people's lives, and this is what we have to give, and we should give it.
Did it change your life?
Oh, no doubt. I was kind of an invisible girl when I was young. I was more like Charisse in my novel. And I never felt particularly special. I mean, I didn't have low self-esteem, but I never felt sparkly or that I had anything to say. And I went to Spelman College, and I met the president of Spelman at the time, Jeanetta Cole. And she had heard that I was a writer, and she once said to me, "How's the writing?" And it was like someone had touched me with a magic wand. And then I started taking my writing more seriously. And
I'm a writer. Someone said I was
yes,
a writer.
Not someone. Jeanetta Cole said I was a writer. The most amazing person I had ever seen in real life said that I was a writer. And so I became known for it. And people started asking me, what did I think about this or that thing? Would I be willing to write for the school paper? It gave me value. I felt that I had something to contribute through writing. And I couldn't help but think, wow, what would happen if someone went to teenage girls in high school and said, you know, you have more to worry about than who's going to take you to the prom because you have something to say that matters.
So you decided to spread some of the fairy dust yourself.
It's very important. And my organization that I work with, Girls Right Now, our girls all finish high school. 100% of them are going to college. The writing and the mentoring really has changed their lives. It's amazing.
Tayari Jones is the author of Silver Sparrow. Tayari, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A new video game offers up another way to experience life in the LAPD, circa 1947.
We'll get a commendation if we crack this murder code.
You sure the homicide squad won't step in and take the collar?
Even if they do, we play along, and who knows, we might get bumped up a desk.
That's him! Get him!
That's Cole Phelps, a returning World War II vet who's solving crimes and working his way up from beat cop to detective. In the much-anticipated L.A. Noire out this week, a player can step into the gumshoes of Cole Phelps as he pursues a host of suspects, from a dicey Hollywood movie producer to crooked cops. L.A. Noire is from Rockstar Games, the company behind the fabulously successful Grand Theft Auto video game franchise. For this latest game, the makers meticulously recreated Los Angeles of the late 1940s using old maps and photos from the time. Harold Goldberg is a video game scholar and critic who spent many hours already playing L.A. Noire.
It's a game that is very film-like, and it just feels, you know, like anything from Hitchcock to Scorsese. It feels like being in a film sometimes.
Walk us through a scenario of being the cop, Cole Phelps. What might he be doing?
So what you may be doing is being called to a murder scene, and you'll check out a body, trying to see if there are any clues on the body or nearby.
We had a shooting took place down this alleyway. I need you guys to try and recover the gat. Happy hunting.
You'll perhaps walk into the bar that's nearby and ask people, you know, did you see this murder? What happened outside?
But again, these are like, as in a movie, scenes, but you're in them.
You're deeply in it, and you know, sometimes you don't want to leave. I ended up in a diner on one of the cases, and I kind of wanted to sit there and order pancakes and not continue on my quest to find out why this devious Hollywood producer did what he did.
The gameplay itself, I gather, is a bit different from most games. Explain that.
The gameplay is a bit slower and more deliberate than in other games. So much of the game is interrogating suspects, and they have a new technology which captures faces so well that you're able to look at a face and decide whether the person is telling the truth or not. And the writing is often so nice that you feel like you're inside Dragnet or Law and Order or something like that. And there's a really nice dramatic arc with all of these as well that keeps it from being boring.
That would be because the writing is more important here than in previous games?
Yeah, well, Rockstar, the people at Rockstar have always been considered pretty good writers. And, you know, I think that this game is as good as some of our better Hollywood scripts.
Oh, really? Do you think so? That good?
Yeah, I think it's that good. I mean, there's been this, for almost 20 years, you know, Hollywood and game makers have had this kind of uneasy relationship. But I think with L.A. Noire and a few games before this, game makers beat filmmakers at their own game so that the writing becomes taut and witty, and it's really quite nice all around.
Well, then are they hoping that they'll bring in new people? That is to say, people who don't play games generally will find this one compelling enough because it's just that different or that literary?
Yeah, I do think so. And it's one of these games that's called an open world game, so you can kind of leave your current case and drive around. I mean, I checked out Pershing Square in L.A. from 1947 because it's an area that I know downtown L.A. fairly well. So it's really kind of fun. And, you have these 8 square miles of Los Angeles to check out.
How much of a gamble is it for the company, though, to go for maybe a non-gamer community? Would it maybe not have enough action for traditional gamers, and that could be a problem?
It treads this interesting line of being very accessible to a non-gamer and yet appealing to people who play games a lot. It's a big, big gamble. It's tens of millions of dollars. But I think they've done it right, and I think Rockstar also is kind of like the Beatles of video game companies right now. They seem not to be able to do anything wrong, so people will flock to something they put out.
That's Harold Goldberg, whose new book is All Your Base Are Belong to Us, How 50 Years of Video Games Conquered Pop Culture.